School of Public Health and Director of the Sexuality and Health Lab. He is our next speaker. Sex Lab is the name of the lab that he works at. And title of his talk is Concerns Regarding PrEP Accessibility and Affordability Among Young MSMs in the U.S.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for braving the last session of the conference. I should tell you that I have no conflicts. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about potential structural conditions that may actually affect young MSMs, young men who have sex with men, not only awareness of PrEP being rolled out, but also among those who have heard about PrEP already, their existing beliefs, right? So we know that one of the biggest predictors for even trying out something is what you think about the product. Even that may be unfounded. We wanted to understand what do people think about PrEP right now in the context of awareness and accessibility. And then we wanted to see in a large sample of young men who have sex with men, what sociodemographic and structural characteristics could in some way influence people's promotive beliefs about PrEP or more distrust or concerns about PrEP. And then I figured that there were so many kind of cool people presenting today, and I think things are blending and magnificent ways that actually end with a conceptual model of something that we're working on to think about agencies and the role of aid service organizations and where they fit into all of this. So thanks there, because it's perfect. As Sarah just mentioned, Truvada was approved as a prevention measure by the FDA in 2012 in July. And though it's been proven to be highly effective, for the prevention of MSM, the caveat that I think people keep forgetting is that the pill does not protect you by itself, right? The people who participated in these trials, like in the IPREX trial, also received what I think is the Cadillac version of behavioral counseling and medical resources. So that's the place that I'm coming from, which is a pill won't be enough, right? We need to also pad it in some way that people have safety nets, both medically and socially, to use it if they want to use it. And even though it's been out since July 2012, and there, you know, from the NIH standpoint, we have demonstration trials being rolled out and implementation trials being rolled out, at least in where we're at in the Detroit metro area, people are either skeptical about PrEP. There has been no guidance as to how to even talk to people as they learn about PrEP in the test counseling sessions. And whether there's awareness about PrEP being rolled out, I mean, we know it because we do HIV work, right? Mm-hmm. Uncertainty of what it means and the capacity behind agencies being able to not only counsel people about PrEP, but also link them to medical care, right, which is that next step that we have to think about. So the data that I'm presenting comes from a study called the Virtual Love Study that I direct. And these red dots are our participants. We actually had 1,600 participants over a six-month period. I didn't move Alaska and Hawaii or Puerto Rico closer to the nation for any given reason except to fit them into the slide. But what I will tell you is that the original aim of the study was to understand the partner-seeking behaviors and intentions of single young men who have sex with men. So Jason will talk to you about couples. But I want you to think about, I'm a single young man, and I'm meeting people, right? And I want to know about PrEP, which is different than treatment as prevention, where we're thinking about serodiscordant couples and how they may be using it or thinking about it, okay? So it's a cross-sectional web survey, and we spent months, which is why you're seeing it now, but we spent months actually identifying unique cases. So there's a large concern that all online data is increasingly more subjected to duplicated fraudulent cases. We've created a system of checks and balances to snoop a little bit. We tell them in the consent form that we are snooping, don't worry, to make sure that the cases that we're getting are true and not hackers or bots or people pretending to be single young MSM so they can get an incentive. And so the data that I'm showing you is actually the 77% of cleared cases. So there's a 23% who were eligible and were found to be what we call valid true cases, but didn't complete the survey, okay? And so to be eligible, you had to identify as being cis male between the ages of 18 to 24. The average age was close to 21. Single, report having sex with other men, and being a U.S. resident, and that includes Puerto Rico. We recruited through two different social network sites. Originally, we were going to do a WebRDS recruitment strategy. I've done this before with young adults. It does not work well for young MSM. We can talk about that in the question and answers for multiple reasons. And so we ended up doing just Facebook ads and ads on BGC Live, Black Gay Chat Live, so that we made sure that there was enough ethnic racial distribution in the sample. So as you can see here, it was a predominantly white sample. 65% of all participants are white, 17% Latino, 9% Black or African American, and then an other race category that included people who identified as Middle Eastern or biracial or something other than these categories. Because we were so interested in kind of like some of these structural concerns and social variables, I'm using structure here not to talk about the meta structure, but the how structural barriers affect you in the day-to-day life. And so we asked individuals to tell us in the past 3 days if they had been residentially unstable, and that means that you didn't have a place that you could call a home and you could live in. And so 14% of our participants said that they had experienced at least one night of residential instability. 8% had ever been sent to jail or prison. 81% said they had any type of insurance. Now, we don't know, this is the mea culpa moment, we don't know if that's family insurance, private insurance, college insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, or something else. So the quality of the insurance is up for grabs. And then we had questions on sexual behavior, and for the sake of time, I'm showing you only two of them. So one is, did you actually have sex in the past 2 months, right? So are you recently active, and so 71% reported being sexually active. And then we focused on unprotected receptive anal intercourse, or URAI, given it has the greatest potential for transmission of HIV. And 28% of the sample said that they had been a receptive partner without a condom. We found a low HIV-positive prevalence in the sample. It's only 1%, which sounds really weird. Let me contextualize that by telling you it's on the slide that it's close to 20% of our sample that has never tested for HIV. So it chances are that we're not getting them there. But we did have 15% who actually said, well, I don't have HIV, but I've had syphilis or gonorrhea or something else. So for the sake of power and manipulation of the data, I'm linking in the HIV-positive people with people who've had another STD. So I'll walk you through this, but we first asked people, so, you know, there's this thing out there, I don't know if you've heard about it, here's what it does, very similar to what, you know, kind of like the introduction that Sarah gave. And then we said, have you heard about this before taking the survey? And only 27% of the sample said, yes, I actually had heard about PrEP before this study. And so I first wanted to use a multivariate logistic regression to predict who knew and didn't know, and are there characteristics that we can start highlighting. And what you end up seeing is an interesting story for the most part of privilege, right? So older young MSM, those who have higher educational attainment, those who have insurance were more likely to have heard about PrEP in the past. And what's also interesting is that those who reported being either HIV positive or having an STI also said that they knew something about PrEP. So from the context of awareness, the people that we think are high risk, whatever that means, we can disclose, we can talk about that at length, seem to have an idea that, you know, there's something out there called PrEP. Yeah. Okay. So we have these 410 people that we can do something with now, right? Because we didn't want to ask the beliefs out of everybody, because otherwise you have unfounded beliefs. Like, oh yeah, I think this is a great pill. I had never heard about it before. That doesn't sound right. So the analysis that I'll show you is the subsample. And we had three different types of beliefs. One was that they wouldn't take PrEP due to side effect concerns. And a third said that they either agreed or strongly agreed with that statement. Less than half reported knowing how they could access PrEP if they wanted it. And then the last one was, how strongly do you agree or disagree with the fact that you could afford PrEP? Now that is a big question mark that we all have. So it was interesting to kind of see. And 61% of the sample said that they either agreed or strongly agreed that they could not afford to take PrEP. Okay, so let's see what predicts those beliefs, okay? So again, we see that some interesting patterns happen, and I'll walk you through this. Let me get my magic pointer. Here we are. Mm-hmm. Okay, So the first outcome was I would not take PrEP because I'm concerned about side effects. And lo and behold, as compared to white counterparts, we find that Black and Latino young MSM are more likely to agree with that statement. And, you know, you could start thinking about medical mistrust, the history of reproductive health technologies among communities of color, and what that might be suggesting. But there was actually nothing else predicting side effects in this model. The second model, which had to do with I know where I could go get PrEP, actually had nothing predicting it, which is why I'm not showing it to you. Mm-hmm. Nothing is predictive of this model. And then the third is affordability about PrEP. And we actually find that the only racial ethnic difference is that Asian American and Pacific Islander participants are less likely to think that they can't afford it than their white counterparts. The insurance folks also say, oh yeah, I have insurance. I'm less likely to agree with the statement. I think I could afford it. And yet the people who we think the high-risk candidates, right, the people who've had an STI in the past or have HIV, are actually saying, yeah, I wouldn't be able to afford PrEP. And so there's this weird catch-22, right? The insured know that the affordability might not be a concern, but yet the people who we are really trying to reach from a public health standpoint are saying, I may not be able to pay for this. So in trying to put this all together, this paper is actually coming out in an issue for Current HIV/AIDS Report, and I'm happy to send it if you want to read the whole thing. We've been talking that we need to go back and talk about knowledge as a barrier as a public health community and as an HIV community. So we need to understand a little bit more about how are people learning about PrEP, what are they learning about it, how are people storing it in their brains, and that might be about how it works, what it is, whether it's adequate or relevant for me as a human being, and how to get it. And then we also have to start thinking about some of the perceived barriers that I think we're going to be hearing about. So these racial ethnic differences in side effects, how are we going to talk about a toxic drug that actually helps prevent transmission of HIV, and how are we going to present that in the context of racial ethnic minorities? How do we do some policy movement to make sure that Truvada is included in ACA and some other types of insurance systems? And how do we then build an intervention, right? So how do we increase people's self-efficacy if we are going to do this and their access to it? Now, at the larger meta piece that I promised I would talk about, is that we need to think about PrEP advocacy a little bit more and think about what it is that we're trying to say as a community about PrEP, because I think that we're all on different sides, very much as Sarah was mentioning with those scenarios. And so I think we have to think about what PrEP means, who it's for, and how do we make sure that we're not actually shooting ourselves in the foot. So are we giving too much money for initiatives, or are we giving too little money for initiatives, right? And who's making these decisions in the political realm? But I think most importantly is that we think about physicians, but we don't think about community health workers who do this work. And, you know, I learned my HIV 101s from my test counselor, right, and my sex educator. And so I think we need to take a step back and think about what providers are actually doing in an AIDS service organization. And what you'll see here is actually what we've been trying to do, which is, okay, if we were willing to talk about PrEP as part of test counseling routines, what would we have to do? So we're using the information motivational behavioral model to start thinking about test counselor and executive directors and directors of programming's perceptions and beliefs about PrEP, and whether or not they're instituting some type of policy or education for AIDS service organizations, as well as thinking also about, is PrEP even affordable for some agencies? And we still don't know that. So who's going to be able in a community to put this forward? And so I think there's a lot of conversation. I'm looking forward to having some of this conversation with you. But for sake of time, I'll stop there. And I just have to acknowledge my team and NIH for funding this work. Thank you.
Great job. Yes, you did. You did an excellent job. In fact, a little time left over. So a couple of questions.
I was curious about education levels. Was that related? And then also, are you able to look at any sort of geographical variation and how people feel?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we use educational attainment. It was actually quite diverse. So we were expecting, oh, no, it's Facebook. We're going to end up having only a college sample. But the good thing is that because so many people have entered into Facebook, that the original purpose of Facebook has changed. So we actually had quite a lot of variability. And so we use it as an ordinal measure that goes from ninth grade or less, all the way to some graduate education. So as people grow in their educational attainment, you can see that there's this relationship right here. One more about awareness, right? So the more educated I've had access to, right, to these systems of education, the more likely I am to know about PrEP. And it could be because they had an AIDS class in school, or they have access to different conversations and circles of knowledge. But we don't see that in the context of belief. So it's not an issue that some people have less education than others, and that's why they're believing different things. It's not there. And you had a second piece that I... So we divided the data into the four U.S. census areas, and there was no difference between the four groups. So it wasn't like the California people were different than the New York people or the Midwest people, Midwest.
You know. Question in the back?
Just saying.
I was going to just add that maybe even access to the news and how to access information about keeping up currently with HIV might have something to do with it,
mm-hmm.
even beyond the educational.
Yeah, or how attached they are to like the gay community, right?
Right.
So like if you read gay news, chances are that you're going to see this type of information mm-hmm. much more than if you just read the Detroit Free Press.
And if you read the news,
yeah.
depends on
the spin
of your generation. Yes. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Can you pull me back?